Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, and you're listening to The Mark Steiner Show and Soundbites, produced here in Baltimore out of WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, and broadcast on Delmarva Public Radio at WSDL 90.7 FM. On our way to our conversation, I want to remind you to join me on January the 30th at the Governor Calvert House in Annapolis for the 12th Annual Annapolis Summit. It's a two-hour program featuring Maryland's political leaders outlining the upcoming 2015 legislative session. Governor-elect Larry Hogan will be there, Senate President Mike Miller, and House Speaker Michael Bush. And most important of all, you will be there to ask the questions you want of your elected officials. Event details and information at thedailyrecord.com or from Claire Sheehan at 443-524-8101 or go to thedailyrecord.com to log on to get your tickets. And join us. It'll be an amazing event like it is every year. And on our way to break before, we were hearing The Christmas Waltz by Oscar Peterson, this Hall of Fame great pianist, passed away on this day in 2007. He was born in Montreal, became one of the great jazz persons of all time, and won 8 Grammy Awards. Now we enter our conversation here in Soundbites. Let me welcome Dr. Marcus Erickson to the program. He is Director of Research and co-founder of the Five Gyres Institute, lead author of the recent study of plastics in the ocean. Dr. Erickson, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thank you for having me.
And the Reverend Merrick Moyes is with us, ordained minister, writer, communications activist, and teacher, one of the first African Americans ordained in the Old Catholic Church, and currently at a clean energy nonprofit which organizes communities in Baltimore to purchase clean energy collectively. Good to have you remaining in the studio, Merrick.
Good morning.
And you all can join us here at 410-319-8888. You can jump on to our Facebook pages, email us at talk@steinershow.org. And there have been battles here in Baltimore, as you know, over the question of banning plastic bags as one effort that was defeated, passed by the city council, but the mayor refused to sign it into law, and they will not override her veto. So this becomes an issue here and across the country. But a recent report on plastic pollution in the world's oceans was written, and Dr. Marcus Erickson is one of the lead writers on this report. And I read about it in The Economist magazine and then found the report and read it and decided we need to have this conversation on the show. So Dr. Erickson, relate to us what is the essence of this report.
So the essence is basically that there's a lot of plastic trash out in the oceans. We estimate 269,000 metric tons from 5.25 trillion particles. I know those are really big numbers. So of all that trash in the oceans, what really surprised us is that the majority of the small particles of plastics are disappearing from the ocean surface. What we really now understand is that plastic trash in the ocean, it gets reduced, it gets shredded into smaller particles. We're finding them inside lots of marine life, inside fish, that in the ocean, plastics become hazardous waste. They absorb so many chemicals. What we're learning is that this problem is bigger than we thought. Plastics shred, they're out there by the trillions of particles, are inside marine life, the base of the food web that ultimately feeds us. So I think this study, what it does, it tells sort of the world that we have to get a handle on the loss of plastic waste and poorly designed plastic products and take some responsibility and make this right.
You know, and I think that we don't really think about this because we saw some of the reports come out about oceans of great masses of plastic covering the ocean, and that was supposed to be the biggest issue of plastic in the ocean and some of the larger animals who might consume that plastic. But the frightening thing about your report, I think that we have to really come to grips with, and before I turn to Merrick Moyes, is how it disintegrates and how the particles of some of the things that come into the ocean and our waterways as plastic are so small. Some barely seen by the human eye, but consumed by the fish that we eat and by the predators that eat them, and how that's the real danger we're not paying attention to nor seeing.
Yes, that's very true. I think we should look at this issue of plastics in the oceans not as like islands of trash that form, and just the opposite. We should look at it as a cloud of small plastic particles, much of the way we looked at smog in the 1970s. And if people can look up and say, okay, we have to stop this problem at the source. Don't put I recall someone suggesting putting vacuum cleaners on top of skyscrapers to suck up smog.
Right.
We have people now suggesting the ocean and get big giant nets to suck up plastic in the ocean. I'm suggesting no. It's like smog. It's a cloud of plastic trash out there. We got to stop the source.
That's a good analogy. I like that comparison. But and America, I think politically becomes the problem because many things move from the ground up in our world, and it's so hard. I mean, when you watched just the act of attempting to ban the use of plastic bags in our retail stores met such opposition. Saying little old ladies wouldn't be able to carry their groceries, and that. But what it was the people who represented the plastics industry, acting as if they represented the small grocery stores, became the forefront of this. That was able to kind of push back any political advantage to make sense of banning plastic bags.
Oh, absolutely, and I'll say this too. That see, part of the issue around in the environmental movement, as we see it, how it plays out in local jurisdictions, particularly with large amounts of people of color, is people are completely disconnected from these movements, right? And so, what happens is when we hear about people, an attempt to ban plastic bags, everyday ordinary folks who are in these communities and struggling, really don't see the need. Or the thing about it is, well, what am I supposed to carry my groceries in? And then then the plastic industry talks about the cost, and so people get really upset about, oh my God, this is going to raise my grocery bill and things of that nature. Unfortunately, the environmental movement has not done a great job in messaging. There are ways to change behaviors as far as this plastic bag stuff goes, but we have to be willing to engage communities, and that is one of the things that I'm committed to doing, and others, a bevy of activists here in town, are committed to doing. Like, we have to address this issue because the plastic bags not only are appearing in the ocean in terms of particles, but they're everywhere. They're in trees. They're everywhere, particularly in Baltimore, and we have to do something about it.
So, and that's part of the point of what you were writing in the latter parts of the report. And when you say 90% of all the rubbish is smaller than a grain of rice, I think you were writing how we have to prevent plastic from getting into the oceans in the first place. Let's talk about how that takes place. I mean, plastics is a huge industry everywhere we turn. I mean, I'm looking at my studio I'm sitting in here right now. Almost everything in some levels is lined with plastic. Probably there's plastic in both these cups that I'm using, one for coffee and one for water, in around the mics, everything in our cars. It's amazing everywhere you turn. Plastics is a huge industry. It makes me think of I was going to actually play this, but I didn't tell my producers in time, was to go back to The Graduate and pull out that great line when there was one guy says to Dustin Hoffman's character, I just have one word for you, son, plastics, plastics, plastics.
Yeah.
And, and he was right.
Yes.
In terms of making a profit.
Yeah, it is a huge industry, and I could say that I'm not anti-plastic. I'm just pro-responsibility for the material itself. I mean, I have a 20 years ago, a motorcycle helmet made of plastic saved my life. In the hospitals, we use plastics all the time, safety equipment made from plastics, but it's a single-use, throwaway culture that I think is trashing our oceans. So the responsibility, it's got to be up on land. There's not going to be any techno-fix in the ocean that's going to solve this. It's got to be better waste management worldwide. And product waste management comes from the plastic industry really taking some responsibility for the design of their products. And it's not about recycling. It's about recovery, getting it back. I'll tell you one story. 6 months ago, I was in India, and I spent one day, I borrowed a bicycle, and I followed a waste picker, a young man who feeds his family by picking up plastic bottles in the streets of Delhi. And I rode with him, and he was picking up plastic bottles and bottle caps. He would pass up straws and small candy wrappers and chip bags and what they call sachet packets. And I asked him why, and he said, the value's not there. I can tell you, his level in society, he's the last eyes to see that plastic before it goes to the ocean. If there was a value to those products, that packaging, it wouldn't be on the ground, it wouldn't be on the beach, it wouldn't be on the ocean. So I invite the plastic industry to redesign their products, make them valuable at the post end, they're recoverable. And that's where the plastic industry is failing us. That's why plastic bag bans are failing. Plastic bags cost cities millions of dollars annually to pull them out of trees, to pull them out of storm drains, the flooding issues, the urban blight. And the way the industry has fought, and I've done a lot of talks at city councils when I present the science, this industry comes in at the 11th hour with ads that say plastic bag ban is going to raise taxes and kill jobs. And it's
right.
A lie, but it's effective.
It's very
so how do you counter that lie?
It's tough. You've got to get the information out there. And we constantly sort of hit the nail on the head saying, look, this is the problem. Here's the issues. But we're overwhelmed by it's money 10-to-1 being spent against us.
I mean, I would agree with that, but I think also, too, the problem is that the everyday citizenry is not engaged in terms of about plastics, educating people, educating folks about plastics and where this goes. I think a lot of it also needs to begin in the schools with young people around plastics, around where does the bottle go, lessons like that. And unfortunately, it's not happening everywhere. And so this vacuum of information gets filled by non-information from the plastic industry, and here we are. I wasn't surprised when the mayor vetoed the bill at all. I wasn't. In fact, I was expecting it. I was surprised that the bill had passed, but I wasn't surprised when she vetoed it at all.
No, that mayors do this all across the country, and I want to get a sense of how this really happens and how it comes back to us. In the form of what we eat and what may be hurting our oceans and ourselves, Dr. Marcus Erickson. I mean, so talk a bit about that. I mean, you talk about even the name of the institute. By the way, did I say it correctly? Gyres.
Five Gyres.
Gyres.
Five Gyres Institute, and we're named after the five subtropical gyres where plastics migrate to. So I can tell you that once plastic trash leaves our land. Leaves our watershed, flowing down streams and rivers, off beaches, out of the ocean. It's on a fast track to migrating to one of the subtropical gyres, and it's shredding along the way. I can tell you I seldom find plastic bags in the middle of the ocean because they shred to the size of fish food as they're migrating across the oceans. Once plastic gets in the gyres, we find that the microplastics are very quickly leaving the surface, either being foraged by filter feeders or selective feeding by other life, or they're sinking down to the deeper depths and being caught up in currents or settling the ocean floor. So I think the life cycle is from land to sea. In the sea, it shreds. Microplastics flow through marine life and settle the ocean floor. That's the ultimate life of plastics. Now, how it affects us? We know that in the ocean, you've got a lot of other chemicals, pesticides, industrial chemicals, even flame retardants. Other chemicals are persistent that don't mix with water, but stick to plastics in high concentrations. And we're finding those chemicals on plastics are able to, when an animal ingests it, they can desorb those toxins and store it in their bodies. For example, in the South Atlantic, halfway between Rio de Janeiro and Cape Town, South Africa, we were collecting both fish with a colleague, Chelsea Rockman. She's an ecotoxicologist. We collected fish and plastic side by side. And we found, as we found more flame retardants stuck to plastic particles, we found more flame retardants stuck to the fish. This is almost as far from land as you can get on the planet.
Hmm.
So there is this issue of toxins going up the food chain, and the fish we're finding them in, the families call them Ectophidae, those fish feed the fish that you see in fish markets around the world. So it does turn around to bite us by toxifying the fish that are in our plates and households everywhere.
See, I think that's what we don't, that's the part that has to very simply, and I mean because people are stupid, I mean because we understand things and we can see things simply put together. And this is what happens from there to here, and this is how it affects us, which is what we do not see. And that's the work of people like you,
yes,
Merrick Moyes, to be the organizers on the ground.
Yes, I'm often talking about this, but I mean just even if I could go here in faith communities and teaching that all life is connected. And so when people understand that all life is connected, that even though this seems to be at the bottom of the food chain, eventually it will reach here through our markets. We saw that with the mercury and the tuna and things of that nature. And I think that is the message that needs to happen and to get out, that all of this is connected, that it may not look like on the surface, but do you really want to be snacking on flame retardants and pesticides when you are eating salmon? You don't. But it calls for us to really start talking about this and teaching people how to be mindful. And then that will lead to, I think, activism as well. I firmly believe in getting youth involved, because when young people are involved and on fire for something, they will take it to the end. And I think that's where behavior change needs to happen, too, that we really need to start talking about this stuff in the schools. And it doesn't need to be an abstract theory. You know what I'm saying? Like, it has to be real life for real people.
Right. It's almost like I was very taken with the story of Stuff.
Yes.
If you've seen that out there listening, that's a very simple way to get these messages across, by simply showing the connections.
Absolutely.
Letting it go viral for young people to see, this is the connections, this is what's happening inside your body, this is where it starts.
In fact, I became interested in the environment very young by watching this commercial. There was a Native American who looked out on a trash heap, and then there was one tear that trickled down.
Right.
And then we had a conversation with the nuns. I'm a parochial school graduate. We had a conversation about this in school.
With the nuns?
With the nuns. And so about creation care, I guess they were Franciscans, so we started to talk about creation care. I'm like 11, 12 years old. You see what I'm saying? And so it starts from there. But if we don't have these conversations and people don't understand these things, it's very hard for folks to get traction.
And Dr. Erickson, so what is the response as you talk about this? When you have come to testify, I know that the huge forces of money are arrayed against folks who try to bring this to conversation. But because when I read this report, I mean, it just take – all I ever thought about was these oceans of plastic. Never thought about how it breaks down in the ocean and then uses it, and the particles are then eaten by the fish that we consume and the toxins involved. So it's very compelling, but turning that compelling argument into something people can put their hands around.
Mm-hmm. I think what I do when I speak to a city council, I'll give the science. And then what I see is a very typical debate from city to city. And I guess the front line of the debate is, who takes responsibility? Is it the plastics industry and manufacturers making smarter products and paying for recovery schemes like bottle bills? Or do we burden cities and taxpayers to improve waste management? For example, San Francisco, it costs them 17 cents per plastic bag to pull bags out of trees and storm drains and clean beaches. That's the debate, is who is going to pay for it? And I think it has to be shared. We do have to improve waste management. I was in Bali in Indonesia recently, and there's a steady stream of plastic and packaging flowing out to sea. At the same time, we need smarter products, products designed for recovery. And if I could reference, there's one company near you, I think it's in Rhode Island, it's called Packaging 2.0. They've been making plastic for about 50 years, and they are advocating taking back their own products. They make PET bottles and clamshells for salad containers, and they're saying, and they've come to, I guess, come to terms and said, look, we're making plastic. We know it gets in the ocean. We're going to make our product. If you bring it back to us, we'll take it back. We'll incentivize that recovery. Packaging 2.0, and the company owner is Michael Brown. I'm impressed with his attempts to take some responsibility for the production, and we need the entire industry to do that.
I think because it works all through the entire system. It works on local governments to address recycling and why we don't need plastic bags, why we can and why we have to get away from this throwaway society, which is something you talked about. And also, on the very top, plastics industry has to take responsibility for their products. I want to make sure I ask this question, though, because people have heard us use the word gyres a number of times, G-Y-R-E-S. Describe what that means and its relationship. I think maybe people aren't familiar with that word.
So gyres are these natural rotating systems in the oceans. In the northern hemisphere, the North Atlantic and North Pacific are spinning in a clockwise formation. For example, here in the North Atlantic, the Gulf Stream sweeps across the eastern coast and then goes across to the UK and then back down, hits the trade winds, and comes back to the Bahamas. That big rotation, the entire Sargasso Sea, is a gyre. It slowly rotates. In the southern hemisphere, there are three that go counterclockwise. If you ever heard of the doldrums, those are the middle of the gyres where the wind and the waves kind of slow down and stop. If you're a sailboat without a motor, you get stuck. But plastic also gets stuck there, and that's where it quickly fragments into small microplastic particles. So gyres are these rotating currents that attract plastic trash. It drifts there. That's where it fragments. It's redispersed globally.
And one of the things you say in your report is when you talk about Plastics Europe, an organization, a trade group, that reports how much plastic is in there. And I was going to read it out here, but the edge of my article is cut off, so I don't have all the numbers in front of me. But but you're saying that this is way under what it probably is. Could you describe what you're talking about, what they said and what the numbers are, what they mean?
Yes. So the plastics industry, Plastics Europe is one, and it's also the American Chemistry Council in the United States.
Right.
These trade groups that represent all the plastic manufacturers and producers worldwide, they reported 288 million tons of plastic produced in 2012. They do this every year. That's just 1 year's production. What we found floating in the world's oceans, our estimate, is 269,000 metric tons. That's 0.1% of 1 year's production of plastics. What that tells us is that plastic is not hanging around on the ocean surface. And just like I said, it is this cloud of microplastics that's throughout the water column becoming sediment. It's dispersed throughout the ocean. We looked at just the surface. We just scratched the surface literally. There's plastic on beaches worldwide. There's plastic in the water column hovering in the middle of the ocean. There's plastic across the seafloor. So if we take the whole thing and combine, and no one has done this yet on beaches, seafloor, and mid-water column, there could be a whole lot more. We're just not seeing it sticking around the surface for very long.
And when, if we're talking about the America for a final thought, what is the science telling us about, if they're saying anything at the moment, in detail, about the dangers of human consumption?
Well, we don't know yet about the relationship between a fish eating a plastic particle and impacts on humans. It's very difficult to do those kinds of experiments. The implications are that they are damaging. We have seen that contact directly with plastic products can be harmful. There are certain kinds of chemicals we add to plastics to give them certain properties, like bisphenol A. Phthalates will make PVC very soft, like a little kid's rubber ducky. Phthalates, we know, is related to miscarriage in women, obesity, cancers, and other ailments. Bisphenol A has its own host of problems, endocrine disruption. It feminizes males, early puberty in females. These are studies of lab animals that are put with plastic products.
Mm-hmm.
So we see that, you know, plastics do impact us as a consumer product. Once you go to the ocean, it's hard to make those connections. The logic is there, that it's not good for us at all.
So how does that strike you when you hear these? I mean, when you hear this kind of detail of possibilities.
This is completely alarming. And I could see how someone is listening to this program like, oh, my God, this is so overwhelming. What do I do? So what I encourage people is step by step. Do what you can. We can't all do everything, but we can all do something. So what does that mean? I would say first thing, people need to educate themselves and understand that the life on this planet is a web. That is the first part. I think that oftentimes our Western spirituality specifically kind of separates human beings from everything else. And that is the core problem with a lot of people, and their understanding of this issue is that mm-hmm. their life is somehow bigger and better and separate from the fish, whatever organisms in the sea. And so when we start to look at the vast diversity of life and the web that it is, then we have to take action. There are many ways to take action, but that, I think, is the first thing that people need to start thinking about is that what we do affects everything else. And it's very hard for people to correlate this bottle that I threw out my window to, man, this is coming back to me on my plate. But I think that, the scientist said, it does take the plastics industry, it takes municipalities, and it takes everyday ordinary people to really change this, particularly around behavior. We need to change our behavior as well.
I think that this is something we're always going to grips with. First, I want to thank you, Reverend Merrick Moyes, for always taking time for our program, being here, and being the environmental activist, community activist you are in this community we live in. Thank you for being in the studio
Gracias.
With us.
Gracias.
De nada. And Dr. Marcus Erickson, who's director of research and co-founder of the Five Gyres Institute, lead author of the study in PLOS, PLOS1, we will be linking to, as well as the article in The Economist, which is a shorter version of that. But the entire thing is really an easy and important read. So, Dr. Erickson, thanks so much for your work, and I appreciate you taking the time for our program today.
Certainly. Thank you.
Thank you. Remind you, on our way to our next segment here, the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. More information, www.mecu.com. And I encourage you all to join us for the Annapolis Summit on January the 30th at the Calvert House with who will be Governor Larry Hogan, the Speaker of the House, Michael Bush, President of the Senate, Mike Miller. You can get details for the event at thedailyrecord.com or call Claire Sheehan at 443-524-8101 or write to Claire Sheehan at thedailyrecord.com. And our sponsors are Stevenson University, the Maryland State Education Association, and the Center for Livable Future. Join us January 30th for the Annapolis Summit. And don't go away, because when we come back, I'll talk about a campaign that will help bring fresh, healthy food to the people of Baltimore. Have you ever eaten chicken schmaltz? Well, this hour we're going to talk about a recipe for onion-centered chicken fat dish, which is really good. So stay with us. Don't go away. This is Mark Steiner, and once again, Arthur Morgan from Gather Baltimore is in the house, along with Earl Johnson, who's Come Home Baltimore Foundation, joining us to talk about what's going on in the Oliver community with their gathering food, with food distribution, and their plans for the future, and their Kickstarter campaign, which is taking off. So, gentlemen, good to have you both in the studio.
Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate it very much.
Good to meet you. It's good to have you in the studio for the first time, Earl. Welcome.
Yes, thank you so much.
So talk about
partnership.
Yeah, what's happening here?
This is what it was all about, you know, identifying groups that need the food, but also finding someone in the neighborhood or groups in the neighborhood who can help. We need help unloading the truck, loading the truck, identifying who needs this food, just actually working with people who live in the neighborhood. That's like one of the most important things.
One of the things is to take a step backwards. We're talking about, Arthur has been on the show before, we're talking about his project Gather Baltimore, which goes out to glean fields of farms and food businesses across Maryland to bring food back. And I mean, they bring, just don't bring food back. We're talking about tons of food, truckloads of food, and give out gigantic bags of food to people who will, they ask to donate $5 to help defray the cost. That's hardly anything for the food that families get in the Oliver community and around the city that they do. And so that is the work that they're doing. And they're back here in the studio talking about that. It's a very unique kind of program. So Earl, what's this connection?
Well, I live in an Oliver community. My company builds houses and services a lot of different things in the community when it comes down to the residents. And the cool thing about the Oliver Farm Stand is that it is completely ran by the residents. I mean, I'm not talking people my age. I'm 33. I'm talking old ladies. They get up every
old
Sunday.
Ladies.
Every Sunday they get up and they spend 4, 5, 6 hours a day serving people in their community to make sure they have the right amount of food.
And they're there. They're there every morning waiting on me.
Every morning.
So tell me how this – let's first of all, let me take a quick trip here. We'll come right back to Oliver. Give us a very quick
sense of the history of what
gleaning means, how you got into it, and how this began for you.
Started, you know, we have hoop houses. We're growing food. We see how much food we have. We even have extra food. We then have a farm stand down at the Sunday Farmers Market. We see how much food we have left over. We see how much food the farmers have left over. We start talking to them. We get all their extra food from the markets. They say, hey, this is nothing. You know, this is just what we bring to market. Why don't you come out to our farms, see what's there? Then you see so much food. It's unreal what's in the fields that they can't even, you know, they can't afford to pay somebody to pick all that food. And they always overplant. You know, you never know about Mother Nature. So that's gleaning. That's getting all the extra food. Now where we've stepped it up with our refrigeration trucks, we've taken it a step further. We're going to Jessup, which is one of the largest distributors on the East Coast. I'm talking about millions of pounds of food. Okay, these are some of the largest warehouses on the East Coast. Tractor trailer full of food that if we don't get it, they're just going to throw it away. So we get it. We identify neighborhoods that need it. Partner with groups like, you know, Come Home Baltimore, working with the people in Oliver who can identify who needs this food, help us, because I can't load a truck, unload a truck. You know, if we've got 10 or 15, 20 different items of food, you need somebody at each station, each type of food. They're the ones putting it in the bags. It's difficult. You can't always just have these outside groups coming into communities and being there for a couple hours a week and it doesn't sit well with everybody. You better make sure you find people in the neighborhood who live there and want you there and appreciate you there, and you appreciate each other.
I mean, describe how that works for you. I mean, how long have you been in the neighborhood now? You moved in when?
I've been in Oliver about 5 years now.
Okay. Yeah. So tell me about how this relationship started between the two of you and what your role in all this is.
Well, you know, there's always been a big need in the Oliver community. It had a crime issue. It had a vacant home issue. And I've really been involved in all of those issues. And once you realize that the reason why someone's living in a dilapidated house is because they don't have the money to fix their house, which means they also don't have money to provide food for their families. And meeting Arthur was just a perfect synergy. He had the extra food. I knew who needed the food. And we figured out a way to get the food to the community. Anything from delivering it directly to their door, we've done that, to the farm stand where people actually come out, they line up, they get a number, and it gets served by the people that they live with in their neighborhood. Not by strangers, but by people they feel comfortable with. They serve them the food. And it's simple. People are getting food to eat, healthy food to eat on a weekly basis.
And incredibly affordable. And the same thing, it's actually $6 for a donation. You bring your bag back every week, it's $5. If anybody doesn't have the money, you still get a bag of food. No one is turned away. And, you know, it's obvious, though, that we do need the $6 so that we can be sustainable. We're trying to make healthy food affordable for everyone, but you never turn anybody away. Last week, we just started kind of partnering with Hopkins School of Health because they're identifying these neighborhoods also and getting more food into these corner stores. So what we've been doing a little bit more, I'm not good at gathering data, but we started weighing the bags. You know, each of these bags is weighing anywhere from 35 to 45 pounds.
Wow.
So we're not talking about a meal. We're talking about enough food for a family to have for the week. You know, this isn't just standing in line to get a plate of spaghetti. This is having food in your house for your family for the week. So the
That's
food
amazing.
Is there. We know the food's there.
So what is missing now? I mean, what is the next step here? I mean, clearly, I know we've had these conversations before, so... And usually this means that there's something afoot that you're trying to get started.
It's always growing pains. You know, I don't want to cry about funding.
Where are you going now?
It's just it's a fact that I'm better at getting the food and getting it to people. But when an organization grows, you always are dealing with, now we have a warehouse. We have two refrigerator trucks. We have walk-in refrigerators. We are now at Mill Valley General Store at 28th and Sisson, where we've set up our warehouse space with walk-ins. And then we also are going to have coolers there where the bags will already be made up 4 days a week. People will be able to go into a store and grab the bags. They're not going to have to wait in a line for what sometimes it's
sometimes what, an hour.
You know, yeah, sometimes an hour waiting in line, but they come and get a number sometimes at 4 hours before the stand even starts. So you've got somebody spending half a day for a bag of food. With the guy at the Baltimore store, you know, we'll be able to create these bags. People can pick them up there. Or what we're hoping for is more people from other neighborhoods will form groups, hopefully come and pick 50 or 100 bags up, do their own farm stands. Like I said, work with Hopkins. Hopkins can get some of these bags in the corner stores. We're finally making partnerships, but then it comes back to funding. You know, we always have to chase that dollar to pay for insurance, rent, fuel, tires, everything. But it's a worthy cause, and we're trying to make, you know, do the best we can.
And we're definitely are going to do more than just put food in front of people's faces. At the farm stand, we want to have nutritionists. We want to have healthcare providers. We want people. We want chefs. We want people to show them how to prepare food, what foods are healthier for you, what foods, you know, work on your blood pressure, what foods are good for you if you have diabetes. It's more than just saying, hey, here's some food, but here's how the food can increase your quality of life. And we're looking forward to adding those things in the spring.
Yeah,
in the spring.
And food, everyone knows food can be a cure for just about everything on the planet.
So, and what are the logistics for this for you all to do this? I mean, especially if the communities really wanted to create something like this. I mean, it seems there's a lot to do here. I mean, this is very...
It's work, but it's rewarding. You know, you meet interesting people. You see people come together that normally wouldn't come together. I enjoy what I do.
You know, it definitely takes dedication.
It does.
Like I said, for the last, almost going on the third year, getting up every Sunday, every Sunday morning, 8 o'clock, and you're there to 3 o'clock and you're ensuring that people are getting food. But it's a lot of work, especially if you're up in age to spend that time. And it can be snowing or it could be 105 degrees. Yeah. And every Sunday, these people expect us
even
to be out
winter,
there.
This is happening?
Yeah.
We're going pretty much year-round. People need food year-round. We've expanded to a couple other neighborhoods to where after I leave Oliver, then I go and do other farm stands. But we're doing those twice a month. So I'm figuring out these partnerships where those community organizations can do their own stands. You know, I can only do so much, but with knowing that we have the food.
Yeah, I mean, suppose other neighborhoods want to start these stands. How do they
that's,
how
that's
they
when
work
you get
you?
In touch with us. Then we'll sit down. We'll form a partnership. We'll also let them come and see what's happening in Oliver because people need to see how it's done, you know, work out some of the kinks and identify people who can be depended on as far as volunteering and identifying who needs the food. But we know that there's not just one neighborhood in Baltimore that needs food. And we also know that people who work and have jobs are still extremely money's tight.
Right.
And there are a lot of health issues. There's a lot of different issues that we're dealing with here. You know, you can get into many different shows when you start tying food to things and, you know, where it goes, whether it's...
So how do they get in touch?
GatherBaltimore@gmail.com, webpage GatherBaltimore.org. Facebook seems to be the best thing. I can talk to a couple thousand people within a second. And it really helps. Facebook I really enjoy because it just allows me to communicate.
So what about this Kickstarter campaign?
It's just something we've put together. We have applied for some funding, and we're starting to get little bits of funding to come in. But with Kickstarter, you can raise a couple extra dollars to just, you know, we always need something.
What are you raising the money for?
To help with fuel, insurance. Somebody slit our tires not too long ago, so it was $1,500 for a set of tires. They stole the headlights out of one of the refrigeration trucks. It was $1,100.
Stole the batteries
really? Off the trucks.
Yeah, things happen.
Things just happen, and if you can just have some money for some operational things. Uh-huh. I don't even want to say the fact that I spent $17,000 last year just on fuel for one truck, but, you know, you're looking at, you know, $15,000 to $25,000 a year for fuel for both trucks, you know, insurance.
People are depending on us to be there every Sunday.
We have to get there.
It started out as something, it was fun, it was a volunteer experience. You know, everyone says that it's a volunteer experience, it's great. Now people, if you're not there on Sunday, you know, they will come knock on your door.
Yes. People need to
They'll knock on your door.
They will knock on your door.
And they will call me.
They will call you, and they want their food. And it is important that people eat healthy foods in Baltimore.
It is. Everyone. It doesn't matter if you're rich or poor.
Right.
I mean, you know, where do you draw the line? Who would you not help? You know, what if someone, you know, had a big family or just was laid off? You never know.
This is a hugely unique program, too. I mean, it's not something that you hear about every day, the idea of gleaning gleaning food and bringing it to communities and the work it takes to glean food from farms and getting it from big distribution centers and bring back and the bagging all these foods. People get this huge amount of food.
It's a big project.
It's a huge project.
And it ties a lot of neat people together. You know, I haven't mentioned farmers nearly as much as I should, but, you know, we got to support our farmers. You know, we have to support our families, everyone working together.
So as a non-farmer, where do you think this goes?
Man, as a non-farmer, this is you know, I don't grow food, and Arthur grows food, but this is all worth it.
Yeah.
You know, it's all worth it. It's introduced me to a world that I probably would have never been involved in. I gleaned my first cauliflower, and I never wanted to go back out there again. It's hard work.
Harvesting food is hard.
And it makes you appreciate the food that you do get. And even that's why we ask volunteers, even the people that pick up food. We ask them to come volunteer. Figure out where your food comes from, how it gets here.
Understand,
believe me, you have a better appreciation
understand
of your food.
How hard it is. And it's kind of neat, though, you pointed on that. We've gotten into this also, not just with Gather, but with Hamilton Crop Circle, being in these neighborhoods now. Help with Earl, we are adopting these lots. I actually have a hoop house now in Oliver right by the farm stand. So we actually have a small farm that's next to the farm stand, and people can see.
And another one coming. And another one coming in a... It's kind of weird. It's an operation between the Department of Housing and Parks and People where the housing took down their houses. It's a lot that was a high drug traffic area. We wanted to activate that lot. Parks and People teamed up with Gather to give them the money. And we're going to grow food there, activate the lot, displace the drug activity while we're feeding people in the community. So It's a great
and,
thing.
You know, and create a couple of jobs. Yeah. You know?
That's great. And so let's again get in touch, because I know that people can volunteer their time to come do this. Actually, my producers volunteered their time in your fields.
Yep. Y'all came and gleaned. Right? Y'all were out there. Y'all were picking and did a show from the fields.
Right.
And you see, it's beautiful. Farmland is so beautiful.
So the contact.
GatherBaltimore@gmail.com, GatherBaltimore Facebook, GatherBaltimore.org.
So Arthur Morgan, Gather Baltimore, Anna Earl Johnson, Come Home Baltimore Foundation, which does incredible work on its own, bringing life back to the Oliver community. Good to have you both in the studio. Thank you so much.
Thank you to every volunteer and every person that helps.
Yep.
It's a group. It's a group effort.
We're about to talk to Melissa Clark, who is a food columnist for the New York Times dining section since 2007. She's written dozens of cookbooks and wrote this piece the other week in the Times that really caught my attention because of how I grew up. Schmaltz finds a new younger audience. Welcome to the show, Melissa. Good to have you with us.
Great to be here.
Chicken schmaltz. So I thought nobody even knew what that was anymore.
Well, you do have to have grown up with a family who made it. I don't think it's something people find on their own. I think it's something they find through their families. It's a very traditional Jewish way of dealing with extra chicken fat and chicken skin. It's traditional in Jewish cooking. You often take the skin off the chicken before you make chicken soup, so the chicken soup isn't so fatty. And then what I know hundreds of thousands of grandmothers would do would be to take this chicken skin and the fat, cut it up, and to fry it until the little bits of skin get crisp and golden and crackling, and then you're left with a beautiful pan of golden, fragrant schmaltz, which is the fat, the rendered fat, and it is fantastic.
And people actually, and then they store it in jars.
Exactly. So they would strain out the cracklings, you know, the chicken skin, and you would eat those right away. Those were the treat. Those were just a delicious little snack. And then the fat itself could be used like any rendered fat or any oil. I know that people often would fry potatoes in it. It was very traditional to do that. During Hanukkah, you fry latkes in it.
Right.
But you could also use it for any time that you needed any kind of fat for cooking. You could use it in matzo balls. You could use it in for searing other kinds of meat. You could use it for the fat for sautéing. I mean, it was really the household fat in pretty much any Jewish household.
You're making my youthful juvenile of the past salivary glands move here. I can remember my grandmother always, she made schmaltz out of duck fat, out of goose fat, out of chicken fat, anything that was poultry. She created these vats of schmaltz.
And she would keep it in a jar by the windowsill where it was cool, right?
Exactly.
Or in the fridge.
Exactly, yep. Exactly. So, but, you know, we always heard, though, that this is what clogs our arteries. It makes, that kills us, that is not good for us.
Yes, it did get a bad reputation. That is very true. But, you know, it has been rehabilitated in the health community. And let me tell you why.
Okay.
No, it's true. Because it turns out, you know, for decades, scientists really believed that saturated animal fat was the cause of heart disease, and now we are not so sure of that fact. And in fact, it's looking like processed fats, trans fats, for example, are really the cause of heart disease, and not natural animal fats that have been rendered. Now, not to say they're the best thing you should eat. I mean, they do cause weight gain. You know, they're not, you know, they're not health food, but you can eat them every once in a while. They can be a treat for you. And here's something else that I learned in my research. Chicken fat in particular has the lowest amount of saturated fat of all of the animal fats. Less saturated fat than lard, less saturated fat than duck fat, than beef fat. It stays liquid at room temperature. So this fat is, of all the animal fats, it is the best one for you.
Now, what about you? Have you used it?
Oh, I love it. I use it. You know, I grew up with it. I grew up with my grandmother making it. My father used to make it, and we would eat it all the time. Then, you know, like everyone else, I didn't have it for many decades, and I found it again. I was starting to do research. You know, what made me really think about it was duck fat. In French restaurants and in French cuisine, duck fat never went out of style. It was always very much a part of classical French cuisine. And when I was cooking recipes from that genre, I would always see recipes calling for duck fat, and I thought, well, why not chicken fat? I mean, this is my heritage. So it was really, I came from it from two places.
Well, so, you know, and I and because in fancy restaurants, it's don't call them fee, right?
Yeah, exactly. You get duck confit. You know, and what's interesting is that when you get duck confit, it is so expensive. And, you know, when you buy a duck, this is very expensive. But everyone has chicken. I mean, how much chicken fat do people throw out? So much, right? You buy a chicken, you cut the extra skin off before you roast it, or maybe you take the skin off, and that just goes in the garbage. And it is much more environmentally, you know, correct to use the whole animal, to use all of it. And so you're really getting a freebie here.
But it seems, from the things you've been writing, that it's had this renaissance in restaurants, in high-end restaurants. Chefs
Yeah.
are kind of discovering it all over again.
I think that's true, and I think that is because they've been using, there's more whole animal cookery. People are trying to use the whole animal, so they are rendering out all the fats. You know, especially these days in high-end restaurants, they're spending a lot of money on getting, you know, humanely raised, grass-fed animals that have had a life to roam and eat. If they're pigs, they're eating acorns. If they're ducks, or chickens, you know, they're pecking at grass and grubs, and they're eating this varied diet, and they're growing up. They're being raised in these very healthful conditions in order for their meat to be flavorful. And the byproduct of that is the fat. So you get this incredibly flavorful fat. You know, it just tastes like, it really tastes earthy. It tastes wild. It has personality. It's not just sort of a greasy fat like a canola oil. It has flavor.
So since we're in the midst of Hanukkah, let me ask you these two things. You had two recipes. Let's talk about these two if we have a minute.
Yes, of course.
Let's start with your schmaltz roasted Brussels sprouts.
Mm-hmm.
How do we make them?
Oh, that's a great recipe. Now, so, you know, you can use schmaltz. You can use the fat like any other fat. You could use it like olive oil. And the way I like to cook my Brussels sprouts is by roasting. And usually what I do is I take the Brussels sprouts, I have them through the stem, so you get these two little halves. I toss them with olive oil, salt, and pepper, and I roast them at a high oven. And I thought, well, what if I use schmaltz for that? And it was fantastic, because the thing about schmaltz is it's so rich, and it just is so, it tastes toasty, and it tastes nutty. And so when you add this to your Brussels sprouts, you don't need anything else. It just really, it's the kind of dish that using this other fat instead of olive oil just brings it to the next level and just gives it an entirely different personality. And then if you happen to have any of the little cracklings, the gribbiness, the chicken skin left, you can use that as a garnish.
The
but
gribbiness.
Even without it, it's delicious.
I love that word, gribbiness.
Yeah, I know. And here's another thing, you know, which I failed to mention. When people... There are two schools of thought on schmaltz making. You can make it plain. You can just render the fat, you know, with the skin in a pan and just leave it totally plain and pure. Or what Jewish people do, what my grandmother always did, my father always did, was you'd take an onion and you'd cut that onion up and you'd put the onion in the pan, and the onion would get brown and caramelized while the chicken fat was rendering. And so it would add this oniony flavor to the fat, which was delicious. So, you know, that's an option when you're making your schmaltz. Add the onion or don't add the onion as you see fit.
You're making me really hungry here.
So, good. It's working.
You're making me really hungry. And you also have this, since it's Hanukkah, you have this recipe for schmaltz latkes.
Yes.
Same thing, but latkes, you make potato pancakes, but just fry them in schmaltz.
Exactly. And, I mean, I started doing this, again, out of the French tradition. You know, I had gone to French restaurants and I'd had French fries fried in duck fat, or potatoes cooked in duck fat. And I thought, well, what if I did this, you know, with latkes? It was a traditional, this is what our ancestors did. This is what, you know, grandmothers and great-grandmothers did, is they fried their potatoes, their latkes, in schmaltz, in chicken fat. Or they could have used duck fat or goose fat, whatever poultry they had, they would fry it in that fat. And it just gave so much flavor. And so the recipe does exactly that. You just use your schmaltz or your duck fat, and you melt it in the pan, and then you fry your latkes right in that. And it gives a crisp crust and a really wonderful flavor.
I'm trying those tonight.
Oh, good.
And the
good.
Brussels sprouts
too,
as well.
Actually.
Well, I'll let you know how they turned out. And
oh, good.
So two quick things we'll let you go. A, I saw in your byline here that you grew up in Brooklyn and you know where to find the best bagel. My grandfather opened the first bagel bakery in Baltimore in 1904.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
Is it still there?
Oh, no. He fell out with his brother and father, and they all fell apart, but he became a union baker. But they did open the first bagel shop, Steiner's Bagels, in East Baltimore.
Oh, that's fantastic.
And the last thing I have to ask you is this. So what's a good Jewish girl like you giving us a recipe for porchetta pork roast?
I just live by contradiction. I like to keep people guessing.
Well, I appreciate your time with us today.
It was so fun to talk to you.
It was great. Melissa Clark, who is a food columnist with the New York Times dining section, has been there since 2007. We'll be linking to her books and her recipes at steinershow.org. And thank you so much for joining us, Melissa.
Thanks for having me.
The Mark Steiner Show and Soundbites are a production of the Center for Emerging Media, made possible in part by a grant from the Town Creek Foundation. Our producers are Mark Gunnery and Stephanie Mavronis. Our engineer at WEAA is Andre Melton. Our engineer at Public Radio Delmarva is Christopher Rank. To hear this show again, podcast any of our past shows, and find out information from the interviews we are doing on this program, please visit us on the web at steinershow.org. You can also listen to and download our podcast on iTunes. And for Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, and for WSDL 90.7 FM, Delmarva Public Radio, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.